Tour 13, Massachusetts attacks Quebec. Like Montreal, Quebec transformed itself in time, lost much of its character of a mission, and became the seat of the colonial government. In short, it became secularized, though not completely so, for the priesthood still held an immense influence and disputed the mastery with the civil and military powers. In the beginning of William and Mary's War, Count Frontenac, governor of Canada, sent repeated war parties to harass the New England borders, and, in 1690, the General Court of Massachusetts resolved to retort by a decisive blow. Sir William Phipps was chosen to command the intended expedition. Phipps is said to have been one of 26 children, all of the same mother, and was born in 1650 at a rude border settlement, since called Woolwich, in the Kennebec. His parents were ignorant and poor, and till 18 years of age he was employed in keeping sheep. Such a life though suited his active and ambitious nature. To better his condition, he learned the trade of ship carpenter, and, in the exercise of it, came to Boston, where he married a widow with some property, beyond him in years, and much above him in station. About this time, he learned to read and write, though not too well, for his signature is like that of a peasant. Still aspiring to greater things, he promised his wife that he would one day command a king's ship and own a fair brick house in the Green Lane of North Boston, a quarter then occupied by citizens of the better class. He kept his word at both points. Fortune was inauspicious to him for several years, till at length, under the pressure of reverses, he conceived the idea of conquering fame and wealth at one stroke, by fishing up the treasure said to be stored in a Spanish galleon wrecked 50 years before somewhere in the West Indian seas. Full of this project, he went to England, where, through influences which do not plainly appear, he gained a hearing from persons in high places, and induced the Admiralty to adopt his scheme. A frigate was given him, and he sailed for the West Indies, whence, after a long search, he returned unsuccessful, though not without adventures which proved his mettle. It was the epoch of the buccaneers, and his crew, tired of a vain and toilsome search, came to the quarterdeck, armed with cutlasses, and demanded of their captain that he should turn pirate with them. Phipps, a tall and powerful man, instantly fell upon them with his fists, knocked down the ringleaders, and awed them all into submission. Not long after, there was a more formidable mutiny, but, with great courage and address, he quelled it for a time, and held his crew to their duty till he had brought the ship into Jamaica, and exchanged them for better men. Though the leaky condition of the frigate compelled him to abandon the search, it was not till he had gained information which he thought would lead to success, and, in his return, he inspired such confidence that the Duke of Albemarle, with other noblemen and gentlemen, gave him a fresh outfit, and dispatched him again in his quixotic errand. This time he succeeded, found the wreck, and took from it gold, silver, and jewels to the value of £300,000. The crew now leagued together to seize the ship and divide the prize, and Phipps, pushed to extremity, was compelled to promise that every man of them should have a share in the treasure, even if he paid it himself. In reaching England, he kept his pledge so well that, after redeeming it, only £16,000 was left as his portion, which, however, was an ample fortune in the New England of that day. He gained, too, what he valued almost as much, the honor of knighthood. Tempting offers were made him of employment in the royal service, but he had an ardent love for his own country, and thither he presently returned. Fix was a rude sailor, bluff, prompt, and choleric. He never gave proof of intellectual capacity, and such as his success in life, as he did not owe to good luck, was due probably to an energetic and adventurous spirit, aided by a blunt frankness of address that pleased the great, and commended him to their favor. 2 years after the expedition against Quebec, the king, under the new charter, made him governor of Massachusetts, a post for which, though totally unfit, he had been recommended by the elder Mather, who, like his son Cobden, expected to make use of him. He carried his old habits into his new office, cudgeled Brinton, the collector of the port, and belabored Captain Short of the Royal Navy with his cane. Far from trying to hide the obscurity of his origin, he leaned to the opposite foible, and was apt to boast of it, delighting to exhibit himself as a self-made man. New England writers describe him as honest in private dealings, but, in accordance with his coarse nature, he seems to have thought that anything is fair in war. In the other hand, he was warmly patriotic, and was almost as ready to serve New England as to serve himself. Returning from an expedition to Acadia, he found Boston alive with martial preparation. Massachusetts of her own motion had resolved to attempt the conquest of Quebec. She and her sister colonies had not yet recovered from the exhaustion of Philip's war, and still less from the disorders that attended the expulsion of the royal governor and his adherents. The public treasury was empty, and the recent expeditions against the Eastern Indians had been supported by private subscription. Worse yet, New England had no competent military commander. The Puritan gentlemen of the original emigration, some of whom were as well fitted for military as for civil leadership, had passed from the stage, and, by a tendency which circumstances made inevitable, they had left none behind them equally qualified. The great Indian conflict of 15 years before had, it is true, formed good partisan chiefs, and proved that the New England yeoman, defending his family and his hearth, was not to be surpassed in stubborn fighting, but, since Andros and his soldiers had been driven out, there was scarcely a single man in the colony of the slightest training or experience in regular war. Up to this moment, New England had never asked help of the mother country. When thousands of savages burst in her defenseless settlements, she had conquered safety and peace with her own blood and her own slender resources, but now, as the proposed capture of Quebec would inure to the profit of the British crown, Governor Bradstreet and his council thought it not unfitting to ask for a supply of arms and ammunition, of which they were in great need. The request was refused, and no aid of any kind came from the English government, whose resources were engrossed by the Irish War. While waiting for the reply, the colonial authorities surged in their preparations, in the hope that the plunder of Quebec would pay the expenses of its conquest. Humility was not among the New England virtues, and it was thought a sin to doubt that God would give his chosen people the victory over papists and idolaters, yet no pains were spared to ensure the divine favor. A proclamation was issued, calling the people to repentance, a day of fasting was ordained, and, as Mather expresses it, the wheel of prayer was kept in continual motion. The chief difficulty was to provide funds. An attempt was made to collect a part of the money by private subscription, but, as this plan failed, the provisional government, already in debt, strained its credit yet farther, and borrowed the needful sums. 32 trading and fishing vessels, great and small, were impressed for the service. The largest was a ship called the Six Friends, engaged in the dangerous West India trade, and carrying 44 guns. A call was made for volunteers, and many enrolled themselves, but, as more were wanted, a press was ordered to complete the number. So rigorously was it applied that, what with voluntary and enforced enlistment, one town, that of Gloucester, was deprived of 2/3 of its fencible men. There was not a moment of doubt as to the choice of a commander, for Phipps was imagined to be the very man for the work. One John Lully, a respectable citizen of Barnstable, was made second in command, with the modest rank of major, and a sufficient number of shipmasters, merchants, master mechanics, and substantial farmers, were commissioned as subordinate officers. About the middle of July, the committee charged with the preparations reported that all was ready. Still there was a long delay. The vessel sent early in spring to ask aid from England had not returned. Phipps waited for her as long as he dared, and the best of the season was over, when he resolved to put to sea. The rustic warriors, duly formed into companies, were sent on board, and the fleet sailed from Nantasket in the 9th of August. Including sailors, it carried 2,200 men, with provisions for 4 months, but insufficient ammunition and no pilot for the St. Lawrence. The delay at Boston, waiting aid from England that never came, was not propitious to Phipps, nor were the wind and the waves. The voyage to the St. Lawrence was a long one, and when he began, without a pilot, to grope his way up the unknown river, the weather seemed in league with his enemies. He appears, moreover, to have wasted time. What was most vital to his success was rapidity of movement, yet, whether by his fault or his misfortune, he remained 3 weeks within 3 days' sail of Quebec. While anchored off Tadoussac, with the wind ahead, he passed the idle hours in holding councils of war and framing rules for the government of his men, and, when at length the wind veered to the east, it is doubtful if he made the best use of his opportunity. When, after his protracted voyage, Phipps sailed into the basin of Quebec, one of the grandest scenes in the western continent opened upon his sight, the wide expanse of waters, the lofty promontory beyond, and the opposing heights of Leyva, the cataract of Montmorency, the distant range of the Laurentian Mountains, the warlike rock with its diadem of walls and towers, the roofs of the lower town clustering on the strand beneath, the Chateau St. Louis perched at the brink of the cliff, and over it the white banner, spangled with fleur-de-lis, flaunting defiance in the clear autumnal air. Perhaps, as he gazed, a suspicion seized him that the task he had undertaken was less easy than he had thought, but he had conquered once by a simple summons to surrender, and he resolved to try its virtue again. The fleet anchored a little below Quebec, and towards 10 o'clock the French saw a boat put out from the admiral's ship, bearing a flag of truce. 4 canoes went from the lower town, and met it midway. It brought a subaltern officer, who announced himself as the bearer of a letter from Sir William Phipps to the French commander. He was taken into one of the canoes and paddled to the quay, after being completely blindfolded by a bandage which covered half his face. An officer named Prévost, sent by Count Frontenac, received him, as he landed, and ordered 2 sergeants to take him by the arms and lead him to the governor. His progress was neither rapid nor direct. They drew him hither and thither, delighting to make him clamber in the dark over every possible obstruction, while a noisy crowd hustled him, and laughing women called him Colin Maillard, the name of the chief player in Blindman's Buff. Amid a prodigious hubbub, intended to bewilder him and impress him with a sense of immense warlike preparation, they dragged him over the 3 barricades of Mountain Street, and brought him at last into a large room of the chateau. Here they took the bandage from his eyes. He stood for a moment with an air of astonishment and some confusion. The governor stood before him, haughty and stern, surrounded by French and Canadian officers, Maricourt, St. Helen, Longueval, Millebon, Valren, Bienville, and many more, bedecked with gold lace and silver lace, perruques and powder, plumes and ribbons, and all the martial foppery in which they took delight, and regarding the envoy with keen, defiant eyes. After a moment, he recovered his breath and his composure, saluted Frontenac, and, expressing a wish that the duty assigned him had been of a more agreeable nature, handed him the letter of Phipps. Frontenac gave it to an interpreter, who read it aloud in French that all might hear. It ran thus: Sir William Phipps, Knight, General and Commander-in-Chief in and over Their Majesty's Forces of New England, by sea and land, to Count Frontenac, Lieutenant General and Governor, for the French King at Canada, or, in his absence, to his deputy, or him or them, in chief command at Quebec. The war between the crowns of England and France doth not only sufficiently warrant, but the destruction made by the French and Indians, under your command and encouragement, upon the persons and estates of Their Majesties subjects of New England, without provocation in their part, hath put them under the necessity of this expedition for their own security and satisfaction. And although the cruelties and barbarities used against them by the French and Indians might, upon the present opportunity, prompt unto a severe revenge, yet, being desirous to avoid all inhumane and unchristian-like actions, and to prevent shedding of blood as much as may be, I, the aforesaid William Phipps, Knight, do hereby, in the name and in the behalf of their most excellent Majesties, William and Mary, King and Queen of England, Scotland, France, and Ireland, defenders of the faith, and by order of their said Majesty's government of the Massachusetts colony in New England, demand a present surrender of your forts and castles, undemolished, and the king's and other stores, unembezzled, with a seasonable delivery of all captives, together with a surrender of all your persons and estates to my dispose, upon the doing whereof, you may expect mercy from me, as a Christian, according to what shall be found for Their Majesty's service and the subject's security, which, if you refuse forthwith to do, I am come, provided, and am resolved, by the help of God, in whom I trust, by force of arms to revenge all wrongs and injuries offered, and bring you under subjection to the Crown of England, and, when too late, make you wish you had accepted of the favor tendered. Your answer positive in an hour, returned by your own trumpet, with the return of mine, is required upon the peril that will ensue. When the reading was finished, the Englishman pulled his watch from his pocket, and handed it to the governor. Frontenac could not, or pretended that he could not, see the hour. The messenger thereupon told him that it was 10 o'clock, and that he must have his answer before 11. A general cry of indignation arose, and Valren called out that Phipps was nothing but a pirate, and that his man ought to be hanged. Frontenac contained himself for a moment, and then said to the envoy, "I will not keep you waiting so long. Tell your general that I do not recognize King William, and that the Prince of Orange, who so styles himself, is a usurper, who has violated the most sacred laws of blood in attempting to dethrone his father-in-law. I know no king of England but King James. Your general ought not to be surprised at the hostilities which he says that the French have carried in the colony of Massachusetts, for, as the king my master has taken the king of England under his protection, and is about to replace him on his throne by force of arms, He might have expected that His Majesty would order me to make war on a people who have rebelled against their lawful prince. Then, turning with a smile to the officers about him, even if your general offered me conditions a little more gracious, and if I had a mind to accept them, does he suppose that these brave gentlemen would give their consent, and advise me to trust a man who broke his agreement with the governor of Port Royal, or a rebel who has failed in his duty to his king, and forgotten all the favors he had received from him, to follow a prince who pretends to be the liberator of England and the defender of the faith, and yet destroys the laws and privileges of the kingdom and overthrows its religion? The divine justice which your general invokes in his letter will not fail to punish such acts severely. Quote, the messenger seemed astonished and startled, but he presently asked if the governor would give him his answer in writing. No, returned Frontenac, I will answer your general only by the mouths of my cannon, that he may learn that a man like me is not to be summoned after this fashion. Let him do his best, and I will do mine, and he dismissed the Englishman abruptly. He was again blindfolded, led over the barricades, and sent back to the fleet by the boat that brought him. Fitz had often given proof of personal courage, but for the past 3 weeks his conduct seems that of a man conscious that he is charged with a work too large for his capacity. He had spent a good part of his time in holding councils of war, and now, when he heard the answer of Frontenac, he called another to consider what should be done. A plan of attack was at length arranged. The militia were to be landed in the shore of Beauport, which was just below Quebec, though separated from it by the St. Charles. They were then to cross this river by a ford practicable at low water, climb the heights of St. Genevieve, and gain the rear of the town. The small vessels of the fleet were to aid the movement by ascending the St. Charles as far as the ford, holding the enemy in check by their fire, and carrying provisions, ammunition, and entrenching tools, for the use of the land troops. When these had crossed and were ready to attack Quebec in the rear, Phipps was to cannonade it in front, and land 200 men under cover of his guns to effect a diversion by storming the barricades. Some of the French prisoners, from whom their captors appear to have received a great deal of correct information, told the admiral that there was a place a mile or two above the town, where the heights might be scaled and the rear of the fortifications reached from a direction opposite to that proposed. This was precisely the movement by which Wolfe afterwards gained his memorable victory, but Phipps chose to abide by the original plan. While the plan was debated, the opportunity for accomplishing it ebbed away. It was still early when the messenger returned from Quebec, but, before Phipps was ready to act, the day was on the wane and the tide was against him. He lay quietly at his moorings when, in the evening, a great shouting, mingled with the roll of drums and the sound of fifes, was heard from the upper town. The English officers asked their prisoner, Granville, what it meant. Mafoy, messieurs, he replied, you have lost the game. It is the governor of Montreal with the people from the country above. There is nothing for you now but to pack and go home. In fact, Colliers had arrived with 700 or 800 men, many of them regulars. With these were bands of Gurers, D'Blois, and other young Canadians, all full of fight, singing and whooping with martial glee, as they passed the western gate and trooped down St. Louis Street. The next day was gusty and blustering, and still Phipps lay quiet, waiting on the winds and the waves. A small vessel, with 60 men on board, under Captain Ephraim Savage, ran in towards the shore of Beauport to examine the landing, and stuck fast in the mud. The Canadians plied heroic bullets, and brought a cannon to bear on her. They might have waded out and boarded her, but Savage and his men kept up so hot a fire that they forbore the attempt, and, when the tide rose, she floated again. There was another night of tranquility, but at about 11 in Wednesday morning the French heard the English fifes and drums in full action, while repeated shouts of God save King William rose from all the vessels. This lasted an hour or more, after which a great number of boats, loaded with men, put out from the fleet and rowed rapidly towards the shore of Beauport. The tide was low, and the boats grounded before reaching the landing place. The French in the rock could see the troops through telescopes, looking in the distance like a swarm of black ants, as they waded through mud and water, and formed in companies along the strand. They were some 1,300 in number, and were commanded by Major Wally. Frontenac had sent 300 sharpshooters, under St. Helen, to meet them and hold them in check. A battalion of troops followed, but, long, before they could reach the spot, St. Helen's men, with a few militia from the neighboring parishes, and a band of Huron warriors from Lorette, threw themselves into the thickets along the front of the English, and opened a distant but galling fire upon the compact bodies of the enemy. Wally ordered a charge. The New England men rushed, in a disorderly manner, but with great impetuosity, up the rising ground, received two volleys, which failed to check them, and drove back the assailants in some confusion. They turned, however, and fought in Indian fashion with courage and address, leaping and dodging among trees, rocks, and bushes, firing, as they retreated, and inflicting more harm than they received. Towards evening they disappeared, and Lully, whose men had been much scattered in the desultory fight, drew them together as well as he could, and advanced towards the St. Charles, in order to meet the vessels which were to aid him in passing the ford. Here he posted sentinels, and encamped for the night. He had lost 4 killed and about 60 wounded, and imagined that he had killed 20 or 30 of the enemy. In fact, however, their loss was much less, though among the killed was a valuable officer, the Chevalier de Clermont, and among the wounded the veteran captain of Beauport, Judge Hero de St. Denis, more than 64 years of age. In the evening, a deserter came to the English camp, and brought the unwelcome intelligence that there were 3,000 armed men in Quebec. Meanwhile, Phips, whose fault hitherto had not been an excess of promptitude, grew impatient, and made a premature movement inconsistent with the preconcerted plan. He left his moorings, anchored his largest ships before the town, and prepared to cannonade it, but the fiery veteran who watched him from the Chateau St. Louis anticipated him, and gave him the first shot. Phips replied furiously, opening fire with every gun that he could bring to bear, while the rock paid him back in kind, and belched flame and smoke from all its batteries. So fierce and rapid was the firing, that La Fontaine compares it to volleys of musketry, and old officers, who had seen many sieges, declared that they had never known the like. The din was prodigious, reverberated from the surrounding heights, and rolled back from the distant mountains in one continuous roar. In the part of the English, however, surprisingly little was accomplished beside noise and smoke. The practice of their gunners was so bad that many of their shots struck harmlessly against the face of the cliff. Their guns, too, were very light, and appear to have been charged with a view to the most rigid economy of gunpowder, for the balls failed to pierce the stone walls of the buildings, and did so little damage that, as the French boasted, 20 crowns would have repaired it all. Night came at length, and the turmoil ceased. Fix lay quiet till daybreak, when Frontenac sent a shot to waken him, and the cannonade began again. St. Helen had returned from Beauport, and he, with his brother Maricourt, took charge of the two batteries of the lower town, aiming the guns in person, and throwing balls of 18 and 24 pounds with excellent precision against the four largest ships of the fleet. One of their shots cut the flagstaff of the Admiral, and the cross of St. George fell into the river. It drifted with the tide towards the north shore, whereupon several Canadians paddled out in a birch canoe, secured it, and brought it back in triumph. In the spire of the cathedral in the upper town had been hung a picture of the Holy Family, as an invocation of divine aid. The Puritan gunners wasted their ammunition in vain attempts to knock it down. That it escaped their malice was ascribed to miracle, but the miracle would have been greater if they had hit it. At length, one of the ships, which had suffered most, hauled off and abandoned the fight. That of the Admiral had fared little better, and now her condition grew desperate. With her rigging torn, her mainmast half cut through, her mizzenmast splintered, her cabin pierced, and her hull riddled with shot, another volley seemed likely to sink her, when Phipps ordered her to be cut loose from her moorings, and she drifted out of fire, leaving cable and anchor behind. The remaining ships soon gave over the conflict, and withdrew to stations, where they could neither do harm nor suffer it. Phipps had thrown away nearly all his ammunition in this futile and disastrous attack, which should have been deferred till the moment when Wally, with his land force, had gained the rear of the town. Wally lay in his camp, his men wet, shivering with cold, famished, and sickening with the smallpox. Food, and all other supplies, were to have been brought him by the small vessels, which should have entered the mouth of the St. Charles and aided him to cross it. But he waited for them in vain. Every vessel that carried a gun had busied itself in cannonading, and the rest did not move. There appears to have been insubordination among the masters of these small craft, some of whom, being owners or part-owners of the vessels they commanded, were probably unwilling to run them into danger. Wally was no soldier, but he saw that to attempt the passage of the river without aid, under the batteries of the town and in the face of forces twice as numerous as his own, was not an easy task. Frontenac, in his part, says that he wished him to do so, knowing that the attempt would ruin him. The New England men were eager to push on, but the night of Thursday, the day of Phipps's repulse, was so cold that ice formed more than an inch in thickness, and the half-starved militia suffered intensely. 6 field pieces, with their ammunition, had been sent ashore, but they were nearly useless, as there were no means of moving them. Half a barrel of musket powder, and 1 biscuit for each man, were also landed, and with this meager aid Wally was left to capture Quebec. He might, had he dared, have made a dash across the fort in the morning of Thursday, and assaulted the town in the rear, while Phipps was cannonading it in front, but his courage was not equal to so desperate a venture. The firing ceased, and the possible opportunity was lost. The citizen soldier despaired of success, and, in the morning of Friday, he went on board the Admiral's ship to explain his situation. While he was gone, his men put themselves in motion, and advanced along the borders of the St. Charles towards the ford. Frontenac, with 3 battalions of regular troops, went to receive them at the crossing, while St. Helen, with his brother Longueval, passed the ford with a body of Canadians, and opened fire on them from the neighboring thickets. Their advance parties were driven in, and there was a hot skirmish, the chief loss falling on the New England men, who were fully exposed. In the side of the French, St. Helen was mortally wounded, and his brother was hurt by a spent ball. Towards evening, the Canadians withdrew, and the English encamped for the night. Their commander presently rejoined them. The admiral had given him leave to withdraw them to the fleet, and boats were accordingly sent to bring them off, but, as these did not arrive till about daybreak, it was necessary to defer the embarkation till the next night. At dawn, Quebec was all astir with the beating of drums and the ringing of bells. The New England drums replied, and Lully drew up his men under arms, expecting an attack, for the town was so near that the hubbub of voices from within could plainly be heard. The noise gradually died away, and, except a few shots from the ramparts, the invaders were left undisturbed. Lully sent two or three companies to beat up the neighboring thickets, where he suspected that the enemy was lurking. In the way, they had the good luck to find and kill a number of cattle, which they cooked and ate on the spot, whereupon, being greatly refreshed and invigorated, they dashed forward in complete disorder, and were soon met by the fire of the ambushed Canadians. Several more companies were sent to their support, and the skirmishing became lively. Three detachments from Quebec had crossed the river, and the militia of Beauport and Beauper had hastened to join them. They fought like Indians, hiding behind trees or throwing themselves flat among the bushes, and laying repeated ambuscades, as they slowly fell back. At length, they all made a stand in a hill behind the buildings and fences of a farm, and here they held their ground till night, while the New England men taunted them, as cowards who would never fight, except under cover. Lully, who with his main body had stood in arms all day, now called in the skirmishers, and fell back to the landing place, where, as soon as it grew dark, the boats arrived from the fleet. The sick men, of whom there were many, were sent on board, and then, amid floods of rain, the whole force embarked in noisy confusion, leaving behind them in the mud five of their cannon. Hasty, as was their parting, their conduct in the whole had been creditable, and La Fontaine, who was in Quebec at the time, says of them, "They fought vigorously, though as ill-disciplined as men gathered together at random could be, for they did not lack courage, and, if they failed, it was by reason of their entire ignorance of discipline, and because they were exhausted by the fatigues of the voyage." Of Phipps he speaks with contempt, and says that he could not have served the French better, if they had bribed him to stand all the while with his arms folded. Some allowance should, nevertheless, be made him for the unmanageable character of the force under his command, the constitution of which was fatal to military subordination. In Sunday, the morning after the re-embarkation, Phipps called a council of officers, and it was resolved that the men should rest for a day or two, that there should be a meeting for prayer, and that, if ammunition enough could be found, another landing should be attempted, but the rough weather prevented the prayer meeting, and the plan of a new attack was fortunately abandoned. Quebec remained in agitation and alarm till Tuesday, when Phipps weighed anchor and disappeared, with all his fleet, behind the island of Orleans. He did not go far, as indeed he could not, but stopped 4 leagues below to mend rigging, fortify wounded masts, and stop shot holes. Subercase had gone with a detachment to watch the retiring enemy, and Phipps was repeatedly seen among his men, in a scaffold at the side of his ship, exercising his old trade of carpenter. This delay was turned to good use by an exchange of prisoners. Chief among those in the hands of the French was Captain Davis, late commander at Casco Bay, and there were also two young daughters of Lieutenant Clark, who had been killed at the same place. Frontenac himself had humanely ransomed these children from the Indians, and Madame de Champigny, wife of the intendant, had, with equal kindness, taught from them a little girl named Sarah Gerrish, and placed her in charge of the nuns at the Hotel de Bure, who had become greatly attached to her, while she, in her part, left them with reluctance. The French had the better in these exchanges, receiving able-bodied men, and returning, with the exception of Davis, only women and children. The heretics were gone, and Quebec breathed freely again. Her escape had been a narrow one, not that 3,000 men, in part regular troops, defending one of the strongest positions in the continent, and commanded by Frontenac, could not defy the attacks of 2,000 raw fishermen and farmers, led by an ignorant civilian, but the numbers which were a source of strength were at the same time a source of weakness. Nearly all the adult males of Canada were gathered at Quebec, and there was imminent danger of starvation. Cattle from the neighboring parishes had been hastily driven into the town, but there was little other provision, and before Fix retreated the pinch of famine had begun. Had he come a week earlier or stayed a week later, the French themselves believed that Quebec would have fallen, in the one case for want of men, and in the other for want of food. Fix returned crestfallen to Boston late in November, and one by one the rest of the fleet came straggling after him, battered and weather-beaten. Some did not appear till February, and three or four never came at all. The autumn and early winter were unusually stormy. Captain Rainsford, with 60 men, was wrecked on the island of Anticosti, where more than half their number died of cold and misery. In the other vessels, some were drowned, some frostbitten, and above 200 killed by smallpox and fever. At Boston, all was dismay and gloom. The Puritan bowed before this awful frown of God, and searched his conscience for the sin that had brought upon him so stern a chastisement. Massachusetts, already impoverished, found herself in extremity. The war, instead of paying for itself, had burdened her with an additional debt of £50,000. The sailors and soldiers were clamorous for their pay, and, to satisfy them, the colony was forced for the first time in its history to issue a paper currency. It was made receivable at a premium for all public debts, and was also fortified by a provision for its early redemption by taxation, a provision which was carried into effect in spite of poverty and distress. Massachusetts had made her usual mistake. She had confidently believed that ignorance and inexperience could match the skill of a tried veteran, and that the rude courage of her fishermen and farmers could triumph without discipline or leadership. The conditions of her material prosperity were adverse to efficiency in war. A trading republic, without trained officers, may win victories, but it wins them either by accident or by an extravagant outlay in money and life.